You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And welcome to the Christmas cast.
The Festivus cast. Very happy Festivus to you.
And a fine Festivus to you as well, good sir.
We're going to have some airing of grievances happen in just a little bit. But do you remember when the episode of Seinfeld, The Strike, came out and we were introduced to Festivus?
Well, it was the Thursday before Christmas.
Yes.
And I remember talking about it extensively at school the next day, since it was a long time ago, and I was still in high school.
It was a life-affirming moment.
Affirming?
The first time that we saw it, it was the most amazing thing. I mean, we're sitting here in your living room, basking in the glow of your pole.
No tinsel, though. Very distracting.
It would be distracting. It was, when we first saw it, it was like, this is what we're going to celebrate now. This is our new holiday. And that very year, we aired grievances.
I had a lot of problems with you people that year.
And we had a feat of strength.
that I did not. That was part of the grievances, actually.
Yeah.
It's interesting that so many people had that same reaction, that it's actually just a thing now.
It was actually a necessary holiday. Frank Costanza was right. There needed to be a Festivus for the rest of us.
And it's great because, you know, it's something for December 23rd, because December 4th is Christmas Eve, December 25th, Christmas, Boxing Day for December 26th.
Yes.
December 23rd was just, like, orphaned out here is the days around Christmas went, but now it's Festivus.
Yeah, being Festivus, the day before Christmas Eve sounds so weird.
It's very unwieldy.
Yeah, and Christmas Eve is a night, because there's also Christmas Eve Day.
Christmas Eve Eve would be preferable, but still Festivus.
Christmas Eves. But can I start with an airing of a grievance right now?
I think I know what this is, but yes, you may
air
your grievance.
I don't think you do. An unexpected grievance. I have a grievance to air on December 22nd, 2013.
I think I'm going to go along with this.
It was up there with one of the worst days of my entire life.
I mean, my thought throughout much of the day was, let me just go back to bed and we're just going to start this day over and run it fresh.
Can I walk you through the day? So we were in Portland, we'll talk about that in a little bit, the night before, and we had to meet up. My day started with a text from you saying, stop being a douche, answer your phone. Then
I stand by that.
Being tired from the night before because we were in Portland going out or whatever. Then a 2.5 hour car drive in the pouring rain the whole time. Then a stressful drive to CenturyLink Field. Then waiting in a super long line to get into CenturyLink Field. The longest line that I have ever waited in to get into a Seahawks game and missing the beginning of the game. Then the horrendous Seahawks game and the Husky basketball team losing. And then constant rain for the rest of the night.
It really was, you know, there's a lot of talk about how, like, people are more serious sports fans on the East Coast. And I think it's almost entirely because of the fact that the weather is so terrible during much of the year.
That makes you a bigger sports fan?
Because you take it so much harder. Like, if you're in LA and your team loses a game, it's still like 70 degrees the next day. It's hard to be that angry. So I developed this theory after a Sonics opening night one year when the next day it was just horrible rain the entire day. And I was so angry about that. And I realized that the situation was compounding how I felt about the game. And that was definitely the case yesterday.
Yeah, I had a hard time not driving off the road later in the day.
I mean, you were driving yourself around. I was driving you around, picking you up for the game. So I was especially annoyed.
Yeah, it was worse for you. But I did drive later, and it was constant rain.
Just the most incessant, annoying rain possible. Like, never actually bad, but just like a dull headache the entire day.
It really was. I think I might have had a dull headache the entire day.
Probably.
So another grievance to air, and that would be with referee Scott Green from the Seahawks game yesterday.
I don't think you're alone on that one. It's already made its way to the controversial outcomes section of his Wikipedia page.
Well, that's exciting. Do we want to start by breaking down that game at the very end and move backwards, or where do we want to start there?
Well, I think we should start with the fact that you predicted all of this again for the second consecutive week. So we're going to begin calling you Nostra Tristan.
After the game. Three nicknames. Pretty good.
Yeah.
After the game, I told Chris, who I was at the game with, we were walking out, and he hadn't listened to last week's podcast, and I was like, I kind of saw this coming when the game was over, and then he got really mad at me.
It's the wrong thing to say to someone. That's the only worst thing you could say would be calm down.
Calm down, buddy.
Oh, it's not that big deal. It's just a game.
It's just a football game. We'll keep on living our lives.
Do not say these things to people who are angry about the
outcome. I would never say that. I'm okay with people being as angry as they want to be.
Obviously you are. My first thought was, I hope that in the future you use these powers for good.
That's what you said to me. Why don't you start using your powers for good?
And I know it's unfair. You can't help it what you see, what visions come to you.
Yeah. So for this week's game, I'll be predicting a 65-0 victory for the Seahawks. Starters are out by the end of 5 minutes in.
And they barely just keep pouring on the points, much like the Eagles last night.
Yeah, that was fun to look at that score. Also, LeSean McCoy's fantasy score.
And Nick Foles.
So, we'll talk about the Rams game and what I'm thinking for the Rams game and preview that in just a little bit. But looking at the Cardinal game, like you said, it kind of played out as we were expecting a little bit. The Seahawks didn't...
As you were expecting, not as I was expecting.
You gave them an 85% chance of victory. Which they may have still had an 85% chance of victory, but that game was 50-50.
Well, I mean, I think what we saw was exactly the scenario, like the kind of conditions that are going to produce an upset loss for the Seahawks at home. Like, close game where it's back and forth and a handful of big plays make an important difference in the game. So, obviously, the touchdown pass to Michael Floyd, one of those very big plays, but then also the turnovers the Seahawks had, really offsetting the fact that Carson Palmered the heck out of that game with four interceptions, many of them just completely inexplicable.
Yeah, he was Carson Palmer all over that game.
He just Carson Palmered all over the field. They had a very difficult time cleaning it up.
So the Seahawks played poorly. I want us to talk first about Scott Green and why I'm angry at Scott Green, though.
Why are you angry at Scott Green?
Who the hell is Scott Green? Where did they find this guy?
He's not one of those referees. He's like the generic referee. Like in the version of a video game where you just have a generic referee that stands in for all of them. I mean, he's got kind of a dumb guy look about him.
Yeah.
But what really bothered me about Scott Green, I'm sure you have some thoughts, was not actually the interception, but was the fumble that was not overturned earlier. I think that was probably a fair call because of the fact that you couldn't see, you know, the two replays of whether, I forget now who even was carrying the ball at that point.
For the Cardinals.
Mendenhall?
I think it was Mendenhall. Yeah.
Whether his forearm was down when the ball was out because they weren't at the same view, which the NFL really should work on being able to stitch things together like that. But it was a fair call. But he made zero explanation of it. And there are some people that get upset at Ed Hockley and Sean Hockley in the Pac-12. Like, oh, why are they going on and on with the explanation? Look, information is all we have. Transparency is crucially important to me because I can't disagree with your call I have no idea why you called it. Explain to me why you called it. And then you can
disagree with the call.
But at least you know the thought process. That you're respecting my intelligence as a fan when you give me an explanation. And that's why I'm two thumbs up for the hockey leagues.
Oh, absolutely. The problem is when you're at the games, you can't hear what the referee is saying at all. So, like, when they didn't overturn the interception at the end of the game, or the fumble in that case, all you can do is respond to the crowd noise and the way that the players are going. Because you can't hear anything that they're saying. It's really loud and super muffled, and where we're sitting, they're not really particularly concerned if we can hear the referee or not.
No.
So I didn't know any of that until right now. And also on the interception call, I mean, we could tell that they ruled an interception, but the Seahawks offense stayed on the field when they reviewed it because it was such an obvious... It was so obvious that the ball had hit the ground.
I mean, I think a lot of it was set by the fact that, and this is a problem I have with the NFL officiating in general. I understand why you default towards the call on the field, but it makes your calls worse. If it's more than 50-50 on the replay, then you're taking a worse call just because of tradition or, you know. I mean, I understand why you want to avoid that kind of error. You don't want to overturn a bunch of calls when they're very close. But in a case like that where it was probably like 70-30, the ball hit the ground first. At the very least.
Had the ball not hit the ground, the ball would have defied the laws of physics.
Exactly. And that's why I considered tweeting Scott Green failed physics, but I refrained from that.
You refrained from that? I'm impressed.
Yeah.
A ball cannot bounce that high at that angle with hitting off of somebody's arm.
And it was funny that on the broadcast, Chris Myers and Tim Ryan pointed out that this was something that Mike Pereira has said in the past is something that referees use when they...
With the laws of physics?
But then he actually disagreed, did not mention that in his own analysis of the situation on the broadcast, which pretty much mirrored what Scott Green ended up calling.
He said that he thought the ball hit the ground, but that you couldn't tell that it did?
It wasn't certain. So maybe we need sensors in the ball. I don't know if that would work in that
also,
scenario.
Also, in this scenario, the ball would have to hit all the way on his arm. No part of the ball could have hit on the ground, correct?
I don't think so, no.
If any part of the ball had hit on the ground, it would have hit the ground and been an incomplete pass.
It's just such a bizarre way to lose a game.
It is the worst way to lose a game. I don't know if the Seahawks necessarily would have driven down the field and scored, but...
Probably not, given the way the offense was playing much of the game.
We were feeling... they'd just come back from scoring a touchdown and driving down the field pretty easily. Things were finally starting to click into place a little bit. I mean, the touchdown pass that they had to Zach Miller before then was a classic Seahawks play. And it worked out perfectly for them. So there was some feeling in the stadium that they were going to move the ball.
I mean, do you feel like that momentum dissipated when Arizona was able to drive the length of the field?
No, I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily believe in momentum in that case, but I do believe that once they had it figured out...
You think they'd made the proper adjustments?
Yes, and it took a long time for them to...
Extraordinarily long
time. But also, when you only have the ball for 22 minutes, you don't get that much time to make the adjustments. I mean, the Seahawks held the ball for 22 minutes and 36 seconds.
Well, that's partially because they had so many three and outs of their own. I mean, it wasn't like the Carolina game where there was a lot of really long... Or there was a small number of really long possessions for both teams, and it was just kind of whether you happened to get points out of them or not. This was the case where the Seahawks offense had tons and tons of chances and just could not get anything going.
And then also Scott Green making completely inexplicable pass interference, completely inexplicable pass interference call on Richard Sherman, which is something that you don't do against the Defensive Player of the Year in his hometown.
It's not like he was playing against a no-name receiver. I mean, Larry Fitzgerald, if you're going to give that benefit of the doubt to Sherman, I think Fitzgerald has earned that same benefit of the doubt.
It was just every single call that could have possibly gone against the Seahawks went against the Seahawks, and it amounted to them playing a very good defensive game, playing a very bad offensive game, but not being able to overcome that.
I mean, when you play a close game like that, you put yourself in a situation where a handful of calls end up magnified, and that's... You know, the worst case scenario, I think, for the Seahawks. What's your threat level after this game?
Not that high. Sometimes this happens. I mean, the week before, looking at another team, the Broncos played the Chargers, and their offense just didn't move, right? I was talking to you. I wasn't able to watch it. And I was like, what is going on with the Broncos right now? But then this week, they come back and look like the Broncos. I don't think that that's something... I think that the Seahawks played against a really good defense, probably the second-best defense in the NFL, and they're not going to play another defense this good for the rest of the season unless the Cardinals in some crazy scenario make it into the playoffs.
I don't know. Carolina is not that much worse than Arizona defensively. I would say that my threat level has gone from guarded to elevated, and a couple of reasons. First off, you've got the actual ramifications of this. So it's possible that if the Seahawks win this week against St. Louis, this has zero impact on terms of regular season goals,
yes.
Which is strictly you're playing to put yourself in position to win in the playoffs by getting home field advantage. And that's not out the window at all. But there is the risk of players getting injured this week. You're not able to rest guys. And that's a little bit of a downside.
The ideal situation is if they win, they still have a week to rest guys. We argued about this yesterday. The Seahawks don't need 2 weeks to rest their starters.
It's not so much the resting guys is for the rest's sake as it is preventing them from picking up new injuries. I mean, you think back to Wes Welker a couple of years ago in week 17 tearing his ACL.
I mean, I agree. You don't want them to get rusty by not playing for 2 full weeks, though.
Not a major concern of mine. So that's one part of it. But I do think there is also a process element. And in particular, to me, first off, granting that the Cardinals played a phenomenal game, Todd Bowles called an amazing game as a defensive coordinator, really did a terrific job bringing pressure. But that also is a blueprint, I think, that teams will use against the Seahawks going forward.
I just don't know if I'm worried about that. Okay, every team in the NFC playoffs has a good defense, basically, right? The NFC is built around teams with really good defenses.
It's actually built around really good teams. That's the difference from the NFC to the AFC.
But those good teams start with defense. Seahawks are really good defense. Cardinals, if they were to make it, a really good defense. Panthers, Saints are an improved defense. 49ers, really good defense.
I don't know if I'm willing to put the Saints quite in that category. The team you're missing there is the Philadelphia Eagles.
There are two teams, whomever wins the NFC North, the Packers or the Bears, or the Cowboys and the Eagles, who are teams who don't have that same level of defense that the rest of these teams have, but most likely the teams that the Seahawks are going to have to face for the rest of the season are going to look like this, and that's why it's a little bit more concerning.
Yeah, and it's something that we've seen before. I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but it actually was very similar to the St. Louis game in the way that pressure kept the Seahawks ever from getting anything. And it just doesn't feel like the Seahawks have a good plan B in these situations. We haven't seen them effectively use the screen game or anything like that, draws, things like that. It's just basically sticking with the short passing game, and Arizona was able to jump those routes and try to force Russell Wilson to make the choice either between scrambling in the pocket, and they did a nice job of containing him most of the game, or throwing deep one-on-one, which has been a successful play for the Seahawks all season long, but wasn't yesterday.
Yeah, a couple things about the receivers and Russell Wilson throwing deep. First, I think that the receivers had a hard time getting separation because the Cardinals are a really good defense. It was really wet out, and I think that Russell Wilson made the same passes that he's been making all season, and he's been successful making at other times during the season, but yesterday wasn't because of probably the conditions.
Yeah, I think that was a factor. But also, when you're relying on the long passing game, what the Seahawks have done well is they've taken a lot of the risk out of that by the way that they use, the red line on the sidelines, throw to the sidelines, and put it in a position where, except for that one interception by Wilson against the Giants two weeks ago, was so uncharacteristic, a situation where safety can make a play. But usually it's a position where the wide receiver has the best chance to make a play, and it's in one-on-one situations. But those are still low-percentage passes, all things considered. You're trading that off for the chance of a big play, which Pete Carroll values.
I just don't want them to change what they're doing based upon this one game. I want Russell Wilson to continue being Russell Wilson and to have one game where the other team was able to defend it, and they didn't pick up a single one of those. Golden Tate had a 28-yard catch. I don't even remember that catch necessarily, if it was a big play where he went up, but they didn't get any of those in this one game. And I don't want Russell Wilson to completely change who he is or the offense to completely change in week 17 because they had one week where they couldn't hit a big play.
No, I definitely don't think that. I mean, you have your identity, and it's been a very successful identity throughout the course of the year. I think there does need to be a plan B in terms of what can we do when we can't protect Russell Wilson? How can we still make plays? But I think that there is a level of concern as we look ahead to the playoffs for me, and the fact that even before this game, the Seahawks were 19th in the NFL in variance. And it's not uncommon for good teams. San Francisco, for example, is 23rd. New Orleans is 27th, the way that they've been up and down just like the last 3 or 4 weeks. But the ideal scenario for a good team is you want to both be good overall and have very low variance week to week, because that's what reduces the chance of an upset.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. My threat level is higher. My concern about the receivers is much higher than it was beforehand. My concern about, I mean, we had our 7 targets going to Jermaine Kearse, which he came down with 3 of them. 6 targets to Doug Baldwin and 1 catch for 8 yards. Has to be Doug Baldwin's worst game of his entire career.
Well, and I think that points a lot to the accuracy of Russell Wilson. Like, even one of the big plays that Jermaine Kearse did make inside the 10-yard line on the drive where they scored the touchdown, he has to dive for a pass that should have hit him in stride, and he's got a chance to get some yards after the catch if that hits him in stride.
So do you think that Russell was less accurate because of the rain, because of how well the Cardinals' defense was playing, or because he was concerned, he was feeling footsteps because of the weakness in the line?
I think all three of those factors, but I think he definitely was feeling pressure even when it wasn't there. He was getting a little bit happy feet in the pocket. It was similar to what we saw from him early in his rookie season. I think it was kind of a similar performance to at St. Louis last year, which was probably the worst game of his NFL career.
Mm-hmm. Worse than this game?
Yeah, I still think it was worse than this. He threw a couple of picks in that one and cost the Seahawks their chance to... I guess he had technically threw a couple of picks yesterday. But,
one pick.
Oh, and it was not really a pick.
He threw zero picks yesterday. Okay. But the defensive side of the ball, you had to be really impressed. The Cardinals are not a great offense, but picking off Carson Palmer four times, and even the one big play that they gave up at the end of the game, I thought Byron Maxwell defended it really well. I have no concern about the Legion of Boom right now.
No, it doesn't change anything about my opinion about the defense. I mean, they bailed themselves out, but the offense out time and time again with interceptions. I mean, Malcolm Smith's at the end of the first half when the Seahawks failed to move the ball. Another thing, rare special teams mistakes, a common factor in two of the three Seahawks losses. Steven Hauschka blowed a 24-yard field goal.
That was really strange. Only gave up 6 punt return yards. That's nice.
But they had one call back on a hold that there could have been a play there.
Yeah.
If there hadn't been a hold even.
So no worries about the defense. I think that Richard Sherman really added to his defensive player of the year season. I think he might have locked it up.
The 2 picks, yeah. I mean, he's probably going to lead the league in picks. It'd be very unlikely for someone to catch him at this point or surpass him. I mean, he might end up tied. But that, I thought, was the number one criteria he needed to have that statistical barometer to go with the team's success and his reputation.
So do we want to talk about St. Louis now looking forward and a game that the Seahawks, a must win for the Seahawks?
Yeah, it really changes the stakes in this one. And I think one of the reasons that you thought last week might be competitive was there's so much more on the line for the Cardinals trying to keep their playoff hopes alive. This week, that equation kind of flips a little bit.
Here's a weird question beforehand, before we talk about the Rams. First off, a lot of teams are cheering for the 49ers to lose tonight, right? If the 49ers lose, then the Cardinals can win and they're in against San Francisco next week. If the 49ers win, they're pretty much out. The Seahawks, do you think that they rest the starters if the 49ers win tonight or lose tonight and clinch the number one seed coming off of such a bad performance?
No, because that was one thought I had, is had they won that game, had that touchdown drive stand up, it would be kind of unfortunate to have that be the, you know, the thing you're going into the playoffs off of is such a poor offensive performance. I think in any scenario, we'd probably see a couple of series from them just to keep them sharp.
Okay. So either way, I think they might actually play longer, though, if the 49ers lose. So, go Falcons. Right? There are a lot of people. Because while I want the Seahawks to have a game that they need to win, I still would rather lock up the number one seed.
Oh, for sure.
But hoping for the Falcons tonight. They haven't looked bad lately, either. There's a chance.
They're playing hard, inexplicably. Just truth ruining that draft pick. I don't know if I would say they looked good against the Redskins last week to win by 1 point on a 2-point conversion try at home against the woeful Redskins. But going back to the Rams, I mentioned this earlier. What they did against the Seahawks earlier this year on Monday Night Football looked a lot like what Arizona did yesterday.
Yes, there was more pressure. There was also a worse offensive line.
True.
So I don't know if I think that that's going to play itself out this Sunday. So the Rams, 23rd on offense, 13th on defense, another team in the NFC and the NFC West that's built from the defense up. And they have a pretty scary defense. Robert Quinn is probably the scariest defensive lineman in the game.
I mean, he leads the NFL in sacks. He had 3, along with Chris Long, also had 3 in that earlier game of the 7 the Rams had. Now, I think the one difference between them and the Cardinals is Arizona is bringing pressure from a lot of different places out of their 3-4 defense. They're really trying to confuse the offensive line, and they did a phenomenal job of that. Whereas St. Louis is more, we're just going to line up, and our star defensive ends are going to beat your tackles, and that's how we're going to generate pressure. Yep. So, like you said, that's a second-tier offensive, a second-string offensive line without Okung is going to be more vulnerable to that, you would hope, than having, hopefully, you know, Paul McQuiston will be, or J.R. Sweezy, rather, will be back this week, and you'll have your regular offensive line intact again.
And I think that they, I don't think they can block Robert Quinn and Chris Long. Right?
But they can at least slow them down.
They can do their best.
They can continue.
Another 7 sacks for that Rams unit yesterday, and that unit is amazing. They're probably them, Carolina, the best defensive lines in the game. Seattle also. But I think that Breno and Russell Okung, if he's healthy, came out the field for a couple plays yesterday. But if he's healthy, they can slow them down enough to have the offense move a little bit, and I think that the receivers will get more separation, and I think that Marshawn will be able to run the ball against St. Louis.
Well, the stunning thing is they're actually much better against the run than they are against the pass defensively, which doesn't make sense given the strength of, you know, their defensive line. But that really points to the way their secondary has not been nearly as strong. So if you can protect Russell Wilson, the opportunities are there. And we saw that with the Golden Tate long touchdown.
It's definitely true. I think that the Seahawks are going to be so focused on running the ball. One of the takeaways is going to be, I mean, I think this is one place from yesterday's game, sorry to come back to that again, where Marshawn Lynch averaged almost 4 yards a carry. It wasn't a terrible game for him, right?
Well, I think what it was is he had, I believe, 6 carries for 46 yards midway through the second quarter.
It's one place where DVOA is going to make him look worse. His success rate is lower than his yards per carry. But they're going to be so focused on running the ball. When they look at this game, when they look back, they're going to say, we passed the ball 27 times. We're still considering ourselves a running team. We ran the ball sort of effectively, and we only ran the ball 18 times. No carries for Robert Turbin. I don't think Kristen Michael was active. And I think this week they're going to come back with a real focus on running the ball.
I would say it was not effective. I would say it was fully ineffective. So if my recollection about Marshawn's yards per carry in the first quarter and a half is correct, that means in the last 2.5 quarters he ran 12 times for 25 yards. And it wasn't, it was just, there was nothing there. Now, again, credit to the Arizona defense. Did a phenomenal job, has been very good all season at shutting down the run, but so has St. Louis.
Yeah. Well, I definitely see them trying to grind it out, slow down. We don't want to give Robert Quinn and Chris Long the opportunity to tee off on Russell Wilson. We're gonna try to win the game, obviously, as goal number one. Do whatever you need to do to win the game. Keep Russell healthy, not get him hit a bunch of times. Marshawn can take some hits. He doesn't have that many carries this season. He's got a lot of hits left in him.
And I think you just really want to avoid third and long as much as possible. And again, that's the commonality between at St. Louis and yesterday's game. A lot of third and long situations, because if you're running for 2 yards on first down and you're throwing an incomplete pass on second down, that's when pass rushers start teeing off on you on third and 8.
And then looking at St. Louis offensively, this is one game where, so Jeff Fisher, I've been really impressed with Jeff Fisher and their offensive coordinator, Brian Schottenheimer. It was at the beginning of the season, they were doing nothing at all, right? The main complaint, and this was...
I think the bar was set pretty low by Brian Schottenheimer.
there was a Thursday game against San Francisco in St. Louis where Tavon Austin had maybe 2 catches. He was basically not in the game at all. And since then, they've really opened up the offense. They're running all sorts of reverses, trick plays, and I think that this is the case, and this is going to be the case this next week, and it's something the Seahawks will really have to watch for. St. Louis has got nothing to play for. They're just out there having fun.
That's
right?
True. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a fake field goal or fake punt at some point. That's a Jeff Fisher specialty.
They're going to try, and they're going to throw everything out there. We don't know if Tavon Austin is going to play, but Stedman Bailey has been really good also.
His former West Virginia teammate, who was really productive in college, but dropped, I think, to the third round because of his size. And this year, again, he's got an excellent DVOA when he's been on the field. And yesterday came up with a huge touchdown on a reverse.
A Tavon Austin-looking play.
Yeah, very much so. So he's a guy, I think, to watch offensively. Kellen Clemens is Kellen Clemens. He's been below replacements this season. He's not going to make terrible mistakes that are going to kill you. I don't expect another 4-interception game from the Seahawks this week. But he's not going to make big plays, I don't think, to beat you on third and long.
They need to keep the ball in Kellen Clemens' hands, right?
Absolutely.
St. Louis is much more dangerous when Zach Stacy, who's a really good runner, is picking up big chunks of yardage on the ground, and when they're able to execute these trick plays. Right.
So I think it's a big game for the linebackers because they like a lot of those intermediate routes and then also trying to contain the running game. I think the pressure is on that group, and if they do a good job and put St. Louis into those third longs we were talking about avoiding on offense, that's when I think the Legion of Boom can have an impact.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's going to be really interesting if Tavon Austin does play, having him and Stedman Bailey now, who's kind of been activated, right? Having both of them as threats there is pretty scary. And if they can figure out any way to keep Kellen Clemens without the ball, it's going to be scary for the Seahawks defense. Because this is something that they haven't really faced this season.
I suppose not, no.
They haven't faced an offense that's just out there trying stuff. And the last time they played the Rams, it was a much different offense.
And the Rams have been a difficult matchup. I mean, you look back to losing at St. Louis 2 years ago in that game that I called the worst of Russell Wilson's career. a very narrow last final play win this year on Monday Night Football, and even last year in Week 17. Not much for the Seahawks to play for, but they wanted to win that game, and it took them until the fourth quarter to really wrest control of it.
The Rams are the one team you don't want to be playing this week.
Yeah.
They're the team who the Seahawks seem to always play poorly against. They're still kind of our rival, even, in this weird way. And every time the Seahawks play the Rams, forever, they don't look right. Something about playing the Rams mucks up everything that the Seahawks try to do.
I would agree with that. So I think it's going to, if you win, it's going to be much like last week, a low-scoring game, a few big plays.
I think that they probably will pick off Kellen Clements a couple times. I think with Jake Long probably out with a torn ACL, they're able to get to Kellen Clements, and that might make some of the trick plays a little bit more difficult if they're not able to block for them. And I could see them coming up with 3 or 4 sacks. And I think that the Seahawks will win fairly easily in an ugly game.
Odds of winning then? What does that translate to?
75%.
I think I'm at 70%. This week I'm more conservative. I'm thrown by the events of yesterday and this matchup with St. Louis. I am not that confident.
I don't see Russell Wilson really being shaken by what happened. I think that Russell will be back to his normal Russell Wilson self. I think that Marshawn's going to have a big, big game in this one. And I think the offense will move enough, will feel good, pick up the number one seed, and go into the playoffs.
All right, well, looking back before Sunday and the start of the bad day that we had yesterday, we spent the weekend in Portland.
Yeah, it was great. And the most exciting part was having brunch at the Screen Door in Portland.
I mean, probably not quite as exciting for me because I'm a regular. I was thinking about this, and I feel like there are not a lot of restaurants in Seattle that I eat at more frequently than I go to the Screen Door.
I made the mistake by not getting the fried chicken. So they do chicken and waffles, and I don't really like waffles, and I didn't. It's just too much, right? Chicken and waffles together, I would feel like I was going to puke if I ate it. But I had some of your fried chicken. It's amazing.
It's the finest fried chicken I've ever eaten. It's not even close. I mean,
it destroys Izell's and Heaven Sent.
You know, they're working on different things. I mean, you know, this is like, you know, this is artisan fried chicken. It's a little different than going to Izell's and picking up, you know, an order of chicken strips.
Well, that chicken is amazing. It's so juicy and moist with the right spices in it. I could not believe how good that was. But I think that they actually give you too much chicken.
It's amazing, yeah. 3 pieces of chicken with the chicken and waffle. I've finished it in the past, but there's no way I could do it at this point and, you know, manage to walk around for the rest of the day. So you have to split it.
I'm willing to give an official Fabulous Peltoncast shout out to the fried chicken at the Screen Door.
I'm willing to second that.
And then going to the Blazers game, it was cool going to a basketball game. I haven't been to one in 2 years.
The very first basketball game for your son, or NBA game at least.
And I found myself kind of bored at times. You know, it's weird. When you're not going to a basketball game constantly, you're not in that sort of, like, space and mindset of watching an NBA game and the pacing of it. And when I was going to Sonics games twice a week, it was, I just got it all, right?
So you were bored because there wasn't timeout, kickoff, timeout again?
It's all about understanding what you're doing there, right? We were really far away, so you felt kind of removed from the game. Robin Lopez kept randomly talking to the crowd, which I kind of liked.
Yeah, oh, you can't complain about that.
But it was just like the whole pacing of it. I was like, oh, this is what an NBA game feels like. I kind of had forgotten.
I thought it was one of the more entertaining games I've seen. I mean, Anthony Davis is just a freak of nature. It's the first time I'd seen him play since before his rookie season. I caught like 5 minutes of him when he was playing garbage time for USA Basketball in Las Vegas before the Olympics. And he is amazing to watch. And then him and Damian Lillard, 2 second-year guys, that's going to be, they're obviously very different positions, totally different styles of play, but a great matchup to watch.
Damian Lillard is awesome. It's really awesome watching him. He is the modern Gary Payton. He's the Gary Payton for this generation.
Yeah, the fact that he's got that same kind of just Oakland swagger, and it manifests in itself in a different way. He's a quiet killer as opposed to GP, who was going to tell you exactly how he was going to beat you.
Damian
and then
Lillard
do it.
Might grow into that.
He might. I don't think it's his personality, though. But he is unbelievably confident. He had 2 plays at the end of the game, which you alas missed. But first, took a charge from Drew Holiday, read the play correctly, did that with 5 fouls where he risked fouling out had he drawn a block, and then comes back to the other end, pulls up off a screen and hits about a 28-foot three-pointer, nothing but net.
I saw that. The other reason that I might have been a little bit bored is that the most exciting part of the game I missed, because when you have a small baby and it's way past his bedtime, he starts freaking out, and you're in a very packed-in crowd.
But that's that. The amazing thing is that was only his third best shot in the past week, because he had the two game winners earlier.
And beating the buzzer in the third quarter with a little flick-in, that was pretty exciting.
A well-designed play by Terry Stotts, my coach of the year so far this season.
Awesome. I look forward to hopefully going to more Blazers games. But like I said, having season tickets and being able to go constantly, you get to know the players, you know the trends, you know what they're doing. Watching the Blazers on TV and going is just different. So what I'm saying is I hope that a team comes back to Seattle.
That's what I want for Christmas.
I'll be in mid-season form as a fan, right? I'm still in preseason form as an NBA fan.
Yeah, I'm pretty mid-season form at this point.
I would imagine. You've been to a lot of games. So let's talk about the NBA. The Christmas of the NBA. Oh, it's Christmas also. It's coming. And let's preview those games. It's the biggest day of the year for the NBA.
Yeah, we talked about it. Thanksgiving belongs to the NFL, and Christmas now belongs to the NBA. So five games, basically all day. You do not have to talk to your family whatsoever if you don't want to. You can just sit in front of the couch. Now, if you do want to talk to your family, I recommend the 9 a.m. Pacific time slot. The Chicago Bulls and Brooklyn Nets, a little bit of luster off this matchup.
Yeah, so let's go through these game by game. I'll introduce it. You talk about something to pay attention to, something interesting about the game, something you'll be watching, a player who you might be watching, something, if you can find anything for the Chicago and Brooklyn game. Anyway, I also have some descriptions of how the game is going to fit into your day.
Okay.
So we've got at 9 a.m., Chicago at Brooklyn, which is a.k.a. the game you don't watch because you're opening presents.
And you may not miss much because the Bulls are painful to watch without Derrick Rose, unfortunately. You know, this looked like it was going to be a matchup of two of the best teams in the Eastern Conference, but Chicago, because of that injury, hasn't been the same, and Brooklyn has been just ravaged by injuries, the most recent one being Brook Lopez breaking his foot on Friday night and presumably being out for the season. So that's, I think, what I will be watching in that game is what did the Nets do without Brook Lopez? How do they replace him with Andre Blatch moving into the starting lineup? Oh,
thrilling. That's going to be thrilling stuff. You know, one of the things about watching basketball is you always like to watch young players, right? Young Anthony Davis, somebody like that. Young yes. and exciting players. And in these 10 teams that they have, I feel like there are very few of those players. There's no player to watch in Chicago at Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Butler just doesn't have that kind of style. He's a fine young player, but he's a role player.
He's a fine young man. Okay, and then at 11:30, we've got Oklahoma City at New York, which I have as AKA the game you don't watch because you're traveling.
So this, again, I looked at the start of the season. You've got Kevin Durant, Carmelo Anthony, the two best scorers in the league, but the Knicks have been so miserable that they have just kind of...
Again, as your computer predicted.
And worse
You were correct, that. Computer. Good
worse
job.
Than the computer projected, though, so far. So even a worst-case scenario, pretty much. The Thunder have been very good so far. So they do have some interesting young players to watch. Their bench, you want to check out the so-called Thunder U of Reggie Jackson, Jeremy Lamb, and Steven Adams. The latter two of those guys being the main part of what they got back for James Harden. And if you're in Seattle, you'll probably be rooting against them.
Yeah, and in this game, you wouldn't expect to be particularly close either, so...
But you never know. Christmas Day.
Maybe something fun will happen. Garden. I definitely will be cheering against Oklahoma City.
And if it does get to the fourth quarter and it's a Durant versus Melo showdown, then that could be a lot of fun.
Okay, and then at 2 o'clock, we have Miami at the LA Lakers, which is the game you watch while eating dinner.
Yeah. This traditional Christmas Day rivalry between the Heat and the Lakers, going back to when Shaq got traded to Miami, and I think that was the first really big Christmas Day game.
The handshake game?
Yeah, we watched a little bit of that because we were in Mexico that year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but the Lakers, not quite on Miami's level this year, but at times they've played really well. They've actually been much better without Kobe in the lineup this season. They've been sharing the ball and playing a more fun style of play without him. So we'll see if they can do that against Miami. I'm skeptical that without a point guard healthy, maybe Jordan Farmar might return for this game, that they can do it against the Heat's pressure defense.
And that game's at kind of the peak time of watching, and obviously having LeBron there, it makes everything interesting. Do you think that it would have been interesting if Kobe was playing in the game?
It would have been a more compelling individual matchup, certainly.
And then at 5 o'clock, we've got Houston at San Antonio, which is a.k.a. the game you do watch.
Yeah, nothing interfering with it by that point because dinner's out of the way. This should be a pretty good game. You know, the Rockets have been up and down, but they're playing some good basketball lately. Dwight Howard has been looking healthy. He dominated Andre Drummond in the post the other night. So he could give the Spurs something to deal with inside.
I've found myself watching Houston a lot lately because they've been playing on ESPN quite a bit. And I always cheer for James Harden because I really like James Harden. But I found myself cheering against Houston a lot lately. I know that there was a notable game that they played against the Blazers. I cheered against them when they were playing against the Warriors last week. And Steph Curry had the game-winning shot.
They played the Pacers the other night.
So I've seen a lot of Houston, and I'm always so incredibly bored by San Antonio. Now, you told me last year that San Antonio is like Duke this year and that they're fun to watch, but I still don't believe you.
I mean, the jerseys may be the same, Tim Duncan may be the same, but their style is, and they're built now in the mold of, you know, the 7 seconds or less Suns, teams like that, where they're just spreading the floor with shooters and running a lot of pick and rolls with Tony Parker, and Parker and Ginobili are the guys running the show, not Duncan. So it's an entertaining offensive style.
Speaking of the jerseys for this year, what do you think of them?
They are the worst. I would give them an official Fabulous Felton Cow shutdown.
Do they all have sleeves?
They all have sleeves. None of them have numbers prominently on the front. They just have the logo. They look like, I mean, they look like a t-shirt that you would wear, you know, or a warm-up. They don't look like jerseys.
I was looking for them, and I thought that they were t-shirts. I was like, these aren't the right ones. They're t-shirts. These are horrible.
They're the worst.
Whose idea is this? I hate sleeves on jerseys.
I mean, Adidas and the NBA are really trying to make that happen because they feel like people are more likely to buy them and wear them if they have sleeves. Like,
they're probably
people
right.
Do that with football jerseys, but not with basketball jerseys, which is fine. But
it
this
makes it
is,
harder to play basketball.
I don't know if it necessarily does that, but they just make jerseys with sleeves on them instead of these bizarre form-fitting jerseys that have a totally different cut and a totally different style. I don't know why they're trying to do that.
Everything about it is terrible. Anyway, and then the last game of the night, which is the Clippers at Golden State, a.k.a. the game you don't watch because you fell asleep after drinking too much eggnog.
And if you do, you're going to miss out. This is by far the best game of the day. The Clippers and Warriors are two teams that always play fun games because they're such high-octane, up-tempo offenses. And there's no love lost between the Clippers and Warriors. They cannot stand each other going back to last
Chances
season.
Of a fight?
Hopefully the holiday spirit will prevent that from happening. But
prevent that from happening.
When Andrew Bogut's involved, you never know.
Oh, man, I can't wait. This is the most exciting game of the day. It's unfortunate that it's the last one. If that game somehow were at 9 a.m., I think that would be really fun.
Hopefully you wake up just in time for the last 5 minutes when it gets good.
They're both really guard-driven, and I think that makes games generally more exciting.
Absolutely.
But you were saying last week that Golden State should travel up and down the West Coast playing all the various teams.
And they should all be national TV games, and no more Eastern Conference national TV games besides Pacers Heat.
Yeah, that's the worst thing, is that there's so many Eastern Conference teams involved here.
Yeah.
Ugh. So speaking of Christmas, we want to talk about Christmas memories for a little bit. Are there any notable NBA Christmas memories?
You remember the one year the Sonics played on Christmas?
No.
I think we barely watched that game.
I have no recollection.
It was the year after we lost to Denver in the first round, and then they played that game, a rematch, on Christmas Day 1994.
They played Christmas Day games in 1994?
Yeah, they weren't as prominent back then, but they did play them.
I thought they started doing Christmas Day games in like 2000.
Well, 2004 is really when kind of this modern incarnation took off, but there were games before that.
That was a good idea. So I want to do top five Christmas presents, but there aren't five great Christmas presents that we've gotten, because there's only been one great Christmas present.
The single most memorable one.
In our family, everybody goes to our grandparents' house, there's a bunch of kids, the Christmas tree is there, and then there's presents everywhere when you show up in the morning on Christmas morning.
Underneath the piano.
It's the most thrilling moment walking in there and seeing, and Santa Claus has just come, seeing presents all over the place, right? Probably 100 presents total.
It's a long period of time just unwrapping all those gifts.
It really does take a long time. But so our family has this tradition where, and it has to be used sparingly, right? I think it's been used too much. Where after you're done opening all the presents, everybody is open all of these massive amounts of presents that are under the tree and the piano and everywhere. You're bored, you're exhausted, you're like, is this it? And then, when you think that there are no more presents, that's when they bring out the huge present, right?
From the basement.
They go into the basement and bring out the huge, huge present, and then you get a Super Nintendo.
Which was our first real video game system that we had growing up. We never had the Nintendo. So this is like going from 0 to 60.
It was like going from 0 to 10,000.
How many hours do you estimate we played Super Nintendo as children?
I can't think of a big enough number.
I mean, your number is probably higher than mine.
I'm sure it's significantly higher. It's not just a Super Nintendo. It's also a Super Nintendo and the greatest video game ever made, Super Mario World.
It wasn't NBA Showdown?
No. Super Mario World is still, to this day, I've played it fairly recently. This is a weird thing, I made a PowerPoint talking about booking that I presented at Seattle U, and the students at Seattle U so it was all Super Mario World themed, and I asked the students at Seattle U if they'd ever played Super Mario World, and not a single one of them had. They had no idea, they didn't get the jokes at all.
Wow.
Special World, they didn't get it.
Yeah.
But then also there's that Mario All-Stars, which is like having every Mario game. That was the greatest gift of all time.
And then I think subsequently after that, we got Griffey. I think that was the best sports game.
Oh, Griffey Baseball. Yeah.
But that was not Christmas related, so.
I would not be the person that I am today, for better or worse, without getting that Super Nintendo.
Wow, that a turning point in your life, really, yeah. The Super Nintendo. We also got a PlayStation on Christmas Day. I think that was like 5 years
but
later.
But we'd asked for it. So the thing about Super Nintendo was that neither of us knew it was coming. Nope. Completely unexpected. I don't remember ever asking for it. And then you get it and you're so excited.
Exactly. It's something that can only really happen at that age, too.
It's the perfect time. Having a baby, I think he's too young to get really excited about a present right now. But I want one of those moments where he's like, yes! So excited about it.
That's like a life goal for you?
Yeah. It's the greatest moment.
But what I always wanted to say about the PlayStation is, do you know why I decided that we needed to get a PlayStation?
Why was that?
Because I was so angry about the Vinny Testaverde touchdown call that wasn't against the Seahawks during the 1998 season, I think it was, that I was like, I need to play Madden right now, and we don't have a PlayStation, so I can't do it. So that was the impetus.
The Super Nintendo Madden wasn't good enough for you?
I don't know if we even had one. I don't think they still made them at that point. You're kind of late on that one.
Been late on every gaming system. The Super Nintendo Madden, if you recall, this was Madden 96. There was some sort of fight that we had.
Yes.
And I hid the cartridge and could never find it again.
The other memory I have is Christmas Day 95 was when we got Madden 96. And I had gotten the flu from you and was sick and could not attend any Christmas festivities. So I sat in the basement playing Madden.
Playing those, like, Maddens in the 90s as a kid was so awesome, right? I wasn't even a football fan. I really knew nothing about football, but was a fan of Madden.
But the thing is, a lot of what we learned about football came from Madden.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's made people much more informed about the X's and O's of the game than they are in other sports.
Especially now. I mean, in those days, the route trees were pretty basic, right?
Yes.
And all the plays were pretty basic, but you know a lot more now. I remember not even playing with the Seahawks, though, and having generally no interest in those Seahawks teams in Madden.
I remember when we had played Tecmo Super Bowl, this is much before that, but I always played with the Packers and started liking the Packers because of that.
You start to like all sorts of other teams if your team isn't good enough and you have Madden. If your team has John Freeze as the quarterback in the video game. Because he was the quarterback in Madden 96, I believe.
Him and I think Kitna may have been on the roster as a backup.
So, Christmas Eve is kind of the big night, right? Christmas Eve beer pairings.
I don't know about pairings.
Pairings.
I mean, what are you pairing them with?
With Christmas Eve.
With eggnog?
Yeah, sure. That's one.
The beer I got to have on Christmas Eve is Goose Island Matilda, which I referenced earlier on the podcast when I had it back in Connecticut and found it a Total Wine and More here in Seattle and immediately purchased the 4-pack of it.
Is that the one that I told you sounded really pretentious?
It's super pretentious.
It looked really good. I saw it in the fridge. It looks really good.
I had one the other night.
It looks better in person than it does online. It has like a 98 from the bros.
Yeah, a very high score of Beer Advocate.
So, sometimes that doesn't mean anything. So, at Rogue this last weekend, got a few beers. The Yellow Snow IPA, because of the season, snowed on Friday. The Santa's Private Reserve Ale.
Which I think is going to go, that's going to pair very well with Christmas Eve.
That's a pairing, see? Yeah. The Portland State University Pale Ale with a cool bicycle on it. I'm excited about that one. And then the Rogue American Amber Ale, which I've never had before.
That's weird, because I know I've purchased that at Rogue.
I've never had it. And then also, I think I'm going to get a fifth of Jameson to put in eggnog.
Well, there you go.
We have this other really cool Christmas tradition where on Christmas Eve, Santa Claus comes, who we call the Des Moines Way Santa, and then gives presents to all the children. And you really think he's Santa Claus when you're a kid.
Well, that's one of my most notable Christmas memories, is the year that we realized it was Grandpa at that point is Santa and chased him out.
It turns out it's usually a family member of yours.
What are the odds?
One year it was even Al.
That was not as good of a...
No one thought it was actually Santa Claus.
No, the beard kept slipping off. It was bad. But he threatened to leave and not give us any of our gifts. That's probably my most traumatic Christmas memory.
Grandpa still does the same often.
There's a lot of coal jokes involved.
Yes.
But it used to be some really big things at Christmas Eve. One year, our mom gave our dad a trip to the Rose Bowl.
On Christmas Eve from Santa?
I forget if she'd won it or not, but he was revealed to him that he was going to go to the Rose Bowl on Christmas Eve from Santa.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's even better than a Super Nintendo.
I agree.
So...
Maybe if the Huskies ever go to the Rose Bowl again, something like that'll happen.
We'll see.
We'll probably actually plan that in advance.
You would think so.
Instead of 6 days beforehand.
Our interest in planning has really reduced the surprise factor
our
on Christmas,
interest
sadly.
Not just showing up for the Rose Bowl. But then also, the other really cool Christmas tradition that we started recently was me drinking as much as I possibly can and then reading The Night Before Christmas to the kids.
Now, see, this is interesting because there's a real difference of opinion between how fun Tristan thinks this is and how fun the rest of the family thinks it is, which is somewhere around excruciating.
It sometimes lasts up to an hour.
Did this grow out of the Dipset Christmas year?
No, it was after that. Okay. I just found the book at Grandma and Grandpa's house on Christmas Eve one year, and I was like, and I was pretty drunk at that point, and I was like, I need to read this to the kids.
And it's classic Christmas illustrations from the 60s.
Yes, it's an authentic 60s book. And so it's like a competition with myself to see, to find that level between drunk enough for it to be fun for everybody and coherent enough that I'm able to read upside down.
And so far the loser of that competition has been you.
The general public. The viewing public loses.
The entire family. I think there was booing one year.
Oh, yeah. There's often booing. There's hissing, booing. Things are thrown at me.
So we've got that to look forward to tomorrow.
It's dangerous. Anything else on Christmas? What a holiday.
It's my favorite holiday. Can't wait. I wish it was Christmas Eve today.
And we will be back on Thursday previewing the Husky Bowl game against BYU.
Until then, I hope everybody has a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.